3 out of 4 Indian women are unemployed. That's more than Saudi Arabia, a country where women have only been allowed to drive since 2018. This is no statistical sleight of hand. In fact, 3 out of 4 is wildly conservative. This number, called the labor force participation rate, includes both anyone with or without a job, as long as they're looking, however passively. Of those 24% of women technically in the labor force, many don't actually work. Then there's the question of what counts as employment. In this case, the answer is as little as 1 hour each week of paid labor. Put differently, of India's 1.4 billion people, 681 million are women. 509 million of those are at least 15 years old. 122 million officially in the labor force, and a tiny 38 million, 8.8% according to one Indian think tank, meaningfully employed. In a country of 1.4 billion, in other words, just 38 million women have jobs. The United States, by contrast, has twice as many women employed in absolute terms, with only 1/4 the population. How can that possibly be true? Could it be that Indian households are now rich enough to comfortably subsist on one income? No, far from it. The country's per capita GDP is less than $2,400, just 1/5 the world average and where China was about 20 years ago. Is it because women lack access to education? According to the World Bank, better educated women are more likely to participate in the formal labor market. Again, no. Strangely, in India, educated women are less likely to find employment. College enrollment has soared since the turn of the century, yet women's participation in the labor force has actually been on a steady decline until very recently. Perhaps it's precisely because women are in school, studying rather than working. Nope, it's not that either, since older women are also missing from the labor force. Finally, could it be an issue of personal safety or cultural expectations? Certainly, this is a major piece of the puzzle. India is one of the world's most dangerous countries for women. Just getting to and from work safely presents a not insignificant challenge. Meanwhile, 99% of Indian women eventually get married. 90% of those marriages are arranged, and women are expected to do nearly all of the housework. An extraordinary 6% of men report doing any cooking whatsoever, and only 8% do at least some cleaning. More of women's time spent cooking and cleaning is less time for paid labor. Case closed. Except, hang on, take a look at India's neighbor on three sides, Bangladesh. The two countries rank nearly identically on the Women's Peace and Security Index. That is, very poorly. They share many of the same cultural norms, practices, and beliefs. And yet, women in Bangladesh work at a much higher rate. Clearly, there's much more to this story. What's really going on? The answer lies in this graph. But first, a brief aside. In India, like many countries, a family's honor depends on the purity of its daughters. Any time spent outside the home, for example at work, exposes women to accusations of promiscuity, tarnishing her family's honor. Parents, therefore, strongly pressure their daughters to stay home. Of course, working also has its benefits. Children are expected to contribute financially. This presents a trade-off between income and honor. And since honor is more or less a constant, the important variable here are wages. For any given family, is the extra money generated by allowing your daughter to work worth the damage to your reputation, and by extension, her marriage prospects? When families are poor, this loss of honor is strongly preferable to the alternative, starvation. Women have no choice. They have to work. Conversely, when wages are high, they offset this honor penalty, causing women to rejoin the workforce. India, as a country, is stuck at the bottom of this U-curve, what Dr. Alice Evans of King's College London calls the patrilineal trap. Wages are just barely high enough that families can scrape by on one income, but not high enough to draw women back to the workplace. Women are trapped between low wages and suffocating social norms. They do go to college, though mainly to find a husband. And they do want to work. In a recent survey, 75% of teenage girls said they hope to find a job after graduating. The problem is that wages aren't high enough to convince their families. The real mystery, then, is why Indian wages are still so incredibly low. Since 1990, its economy has grown at an impressive average rate of 6% a year, not so far behind China's miraculous 8.8%. Back then, India was only the world's 12th largest economy. Today, it's the 5th. Yet, somehow this spectacular growth failed to create any jobs. Now, economists call the number of new jobs produced for every 1% change in GDP the elasticity of labor. Well, between 2011 and 19, the Indian labor force grew by 0.26%, imputing an elasticity of 0.04, which is a polite way of saying virtually zero jobs were created over 10 years. This implies that if its economy were to double overnight, employment would only increase by 4%. Between 1999 and 2005, 60 million new jobs appeared. Between 2004 and 10, just 3. The result is fierce competition for every last scrap of paid work. In 2019, 12 million people applied for 35,000 railroad jobs and 1.7 million for 1,500 jobs at a state-owned bank. Most of these applicants are young, and the vast majority college-educated. Those who are both young and college-educated don't stand a chance. Today, 42% of Indians under 25 with graduate degrees can't find work. So, what do all these young scholars do? They go back to school, of course, fueling a race to acquire an increasing number of unnecessary credentials or else fall behind. Others simply lose hope and spend their days doing what Indians call time pass, aimless leisure. Now, one clue to the whereabouts of these missing jobs is the country's most common occupation. Not salesperson, waiter, or janitor, but CEO. Truly. You see, contrary to the image of sweatshops many around the world imagine, Indian employers are actually quite tightly regulated. Legally, they must provide workers with paid leave, pensions, and health insurance. They even need permission from the government to fire or lay them off. At least, in principle. In practice, most of these laws only apply to businesses with 10 or more employees. And unrelatedly, for some odd reason, Indian companies seem to have decided 9 is the optimal number of workers. So, what do you know? The vast majority of businesses are exempt from these regulations. Another reason they stay small is to evade corruption. Companies with 10 or more workers are visited by labor inspectors, many of which enforce arcane rules to extract bribes. Thus, whereas China has a healthy balance of mid-sized companies, many of which have between 51 and 200 workers, over 80% of Indian apparel firms, for instance, have less than 8. With so many small businesses, it's no wonder India has perhaps the world's highest density of CEOs. As companies grow, rather than hire more workers, they simply outsource this additional labor to other small companies. But this loophole, clever as it is, has a cost. Smaller companies are less productive. On average, those with 50 to 199 workers are about 60% less productive than those with over 200, and those with 5 to 49 workers about 90% less productive. Lower productivity means lower wages. Lower wages means less consumer demand, and less demand means fewer jobs. not just fewer, but also lower quality. Only 21% of Indian workers earn regular wages. Of them, 46% don't receive any paid leave, 53% don't receive Social Security, and nearly 60% have no written contract at all. This flexibility, as employers call it, is stressful and unpredictable during the best of times. When things are anything less than peachy, these informal jobs become downright catastrophic. Like, say, during a global pandemic. In 2020, the Prime Minister declared what began as a 3-week national lockdown, which immediately put 100 million Indians out of work, who fled en masse to the countryside, the only place they could go. By December of that year, 75 million people had been plunged below the poverty line of $2 a day, according to Pew Research. But there's another, bigger, structural reason why India has so few jobs. Of the countries that successfully escaped poverty in the last 100 years, almost all have pursued the same tried-and-true development recipe. A rapid progression from agriculture to manufacturing to services, in that order. It worked for Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, and now China. India, on the other hand, seems to have somehow missed this memo. By the time its economy liberalized in the early 1990s, China was already 10 years into this journey. And having started so late, Indian factories couldn't compete with their Chinese competitors. So they largely gave up. Instead, India skipped straight from agriculture to services, leaving out that very critical middle step in the recipe, manufacturing. Today, Vietnam, with a population of less than 100 million, exports more clothing than India, with a population of 1.4 billion. Now, there's nothing wrong with services. Nearly all rich countries are service economies, from the US to Japan and Switzerland. So you might think India found a shortcut. The country has an impressive depth of finance, insurance, real estate, and technology expertise. Deloitte, Goldman, and Tata pay their Indian consultants and bankers top dollar, much more, of course, than most factory workers. The problem is that there just aren't that many of these jobs. As Indian farmers have grown more productive, as they have across the globe, agriculture has been on a steady decline. No surprise there. Usually, however, all these farmers would become factory workers, one labor-intensive industry replaced with another. But, as you can see, manufacturing hasn't absorbed these displaced farmers. Sure, these new service jobs have helped, just not nearly enough. So, in order to make up the difference, Indians have flocked to construction. These jobs are often temporary, low-paid, and physically dangerous. But this trend is particularly bad for women. In East Asia, where manufacturing replaced agriculture, women became factory workers, which slowly influenced social expectations and afforded them newfound freedom. In India, women were pushed out of farming but discouraged from taking on construction. A few lucky women secured lucrative service jobs, but the vast majority simply left the labor market altogether. They had nowhere to go. This is why India's economy continued to grow. Those new service jobs are very, very productive, while the number of jobs did not. They're few and far between. It's why women in Bangladesh work at much higher rates. Its many factories provide them with a socially acceptable place to do so, whereas India has no such scale. What India does have, that most of Asia does not, is time. China's population peaked last year, and its labor force is expected to decrease by about 1% each year starting in 2030. India, meanwhile, is still very much young and growing. 40% of its population is under the age of 25, and 53% under 30. Its median age is a youthful 28, compared to China's 38, or Japan's 48. With any luck, India has about 2 decades remaining in its demographic window. a critical transition period during which a country has a large number of working-age people compared to children and retirees. If the country can harness this labor, it could still experience a taste of the demographic dividend that propelled China from a poor to a middle-income country. By merely employing women at the same rate as men, according to Bloomberg, India's economy could grow by nearly a third by 2050. But if it wastes this opportunity, these excess young people could become a demographic burden. In that case, it would be stuck with millions of angry, aimless, and unemployed 20, 30, and 40-year-olds. Simply put, India has no time to waste, which means it may need some help from David Allen in his book Getting Things Done on today's sponsor, Imprint. In it, for example, I learn the 5 stages of being productive and when to put something on my to-do list versus calendar. These days, no one can keep up with the endless stream of new books, movies, and knowledge, never mind catch up on all of history. But Imprint condenses these lessons into bite-sized, visual, and interactive lessons, not unlike these videos, making you more widely read and culturally aware in less time. Instead of scrolling mindlessly through Instagram, wouldn't you rather check out those classic works you've always heard about but never had time to sit down and read? Like Guns, Germs, and Steel, or Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers? In addition to book summaries, Imprint also has lessons on current events, like Russia's war in Ukraine, and interactive explanations, for example, of history's great philosophical thinkers. To start learning today, click the link on screen or in the description for a free 7-day trial. The first 200 to click that link will also get 20% off an annual premium subscription.